Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network, with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook.
Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I am your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sundays of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time. So take note of that, folks. Another fork in the road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for an injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anytime, and anywhere. And folks, believe me, it does. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States living with some form of brain injury, but most folks do not even know about brain injury, and I know that I never did, not until it came to live on my doorstep. On Another Fork in the Road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and caregivers experience. On the third Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I host therapists, medical professionals, and authors, a lot of authors. I like to promote authors out there. So, because I want to gain the insight into what they can offer survivors. And on each first Sunday of the month, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression, neurofatigue, anger, or various other symptoms of brain injury. And tonight, we're going to be talking about emotional and behavioral changes, personality changes after a brain injury. So that sounds like a really interesting topic, for at least I think it is. For those of you that are new to my show, here's a little snippet about me. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005. That's almost 18, well, it is. It's more than 18 years ago when my husband David had a brain injury. And so you can learn more about that on my blog. Now, this is where I always remember to say to everyone, please get a paper and pencil so that you can write down various URLs that I will pop out to you. So it's surviving. Traumatic Brain Injury .com. And I'll be saying that more throughout the show. But I'll say it one more time. It's all lowercase. It's all lowercase. And Surviving Traumatic Brain Injury .com. All one word. I shared David's and my story in 4 episodes on this very show starting in August of 2014. And the last, which was in November of 2014, actually featured a discussion with David himself. And then I also interviewed David on my April 19, 2020 show for his perspective on his brain injury. At that time, it was 15 years. So I wanted to see how his thinking had changed and how he saw his recovery. So that was a really interesting show, I thought, too. And also, because David is a retired professor of microbiology, get it out, Donna, come on, microbiology, I wanted to get his understanding of the COVID-19 pandemic, which I'm sure you all remember was beginning about that time. And so I wanted him to give us some insight on what he saw in his research that he was doing about from the general sciences at that point. So you can find my archived shows on my blog, again, at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. All one word, all lowercase. Once you get to the site, just click on the air show menu. You must look for the show menu tab under the category section on the right sidebar. And it's really easy. Or you can type anyone's name. You can type David Fragerski into the search box on the right sidebar to learn more about him. Or anyone's name who you might want to see if they are located on the website for any reason. You can also read our complete story in my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing and released in November of 2018. You can find Prisoners, as I so fondly call it, as a print book, an e-book, and as an audiobook at all your local book cons or your local library. And if you don't find it, ask the librarian or ask your bookseller, because it's readily available, even if it hasn't reached the shelf. But and if you do read it, please, please, please write a review on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Goodreads, because a review is a book's best friend, and it helps to let others know about a good read. Now, I'm just going to do a little aside here, because I think I moved a mountain this week. Because I like to write reviews for books that I like, you know. I think it's really helpful to other readers. And so I went to Amazon to write a review for a friend of mine whose book I just read. And actually, I interviewed on my last show, Bob Millsap. He is the author of Shake Yourself Free. And I wrote this lovely review because I think everyone should read the book. And I went to Amazon to write it. And Amazon, I got this big red note saying, sorry, you don't meet the minimum requirement. And I thought, whoa, what's that mean? So I did the next best thing. I contacted Amazon and said, I want to write a review for this book, and I can't. And they said, well, what is your invoice number for when you purchased the book? And I said, well, I didn't purchase the book from Amazon. I got it actually from the author's book launch. So, which I do often. I get a lot of books personally from the authors because I really am looking to help them to promote their books. So I went ahead and told them I didn't purchase the book. And they said, well, that's the reason why you can't write a review. And I said, well, that's not fair. I read this book. It's on Amazon. And furthermore, my review is going to promote an author's book, which means Amazon is going to reap the benefits, because if someone reads my review and likes what I said about the book, they're going to maybe likely buy it, giving cha-ching to Amazon. Makes sense to me, folks. Well, last Tuesday I sat on the phone for 1 hour. I talked to a robot. I talked to 1, 2, 3 reps. And then I was passed off to the 4th rep, the rep in the payment department. And I thought, oh, this is a real weird roundabout way to get anything done. But it was, in fact, that rep in the payment department that I think, and I'm going to say think in quotes right now because I just checked a few minutes ago, and I think she changed it. She actually told me she was going to change it. And I'm going to actually read you her note here because I think this was pretty remarkable. she said that I totally understand that you want to give a feedback on the books that you have. And in this case, she's going to submit a report to allow me to give that feedback. And she said it will take place on their next update. And, of course, I thought, well, what does that mean? So I asked her, so what do you mean? What is the next update? And then I realized that she means the next time they update Amazon book system. And so when I asked her that, she said, yes, no worries. We will submit a report for this one so that you can give a review to us for the books that you want to give a review. And get this, folks, this is where the mountain comes in, I think. We will update, and I'm quoting now, We will update this one so that all users and readers can review in Amazon, even if they did not purchase the item to use. Wow. Can you believe that Amazon moved on a policy? I can't. I can't. And I just said, do Ella P, Ella May P was her name. And I just said, wow, you can do that? That would be great. And I know a lot of people will be happy, both the reviewers and the authors, of which I am one. So I just had to say that, folks, because I don't know how many people have tried to write a review for my book and make my book to have a new best friend. I don't know how many people have tried and have failed because Amazon wouldn't let them. I know other authors have said the same thing to me. They have tried to review a book, and because they didn't purchase it from Amazon, they couldn't. I think, and I just looked about 10 minutes ago, I think that it has been remedied. And after this show, I plan to go back to Amazon and put my review up for Bob's book. So cross your fingers, folks, everybody, because I think that's really important news. So I'm going to just say, if you want to learn more about me, you can go to my website, which is DonnaFigurski.com, and I hope that you're going to find my show fun and informative. And I hope that if you visit the shows of other hosts on the Brain Injury Radio, that there are shows every night, actually, from 10 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. And you can also tune in at 5:30 p.m. on Pacific time, again, on the weekends to listen to your favorite shows. So although we're airing live at 5:30 Pacific, you can listen at 8:30 or 9:30 or 10:30 or whatever time zone you are in across the United States and in 36 different countries, because that's where we are broadcast. But the fortunate part is, it's not just the United States or the 36 countries. Anyone can go to ibrraininjuryradio.com on blogtalkradio.com to listen to any of our shows because they are all archived. And if you want to go to listen to my show in particular, go to survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com and go to On the Air Show Menu. And all of my shows, more than 180 of them, it might be 200 now, I'm not sure, I never remember, but are listed so you can listen to any show that you want and just go scroll through and see what's there, folks. So I hope that you're going to do that. And if you are happening to be one of those folks that did read Prisoners and do want to write that review, which I would absolutely love, my book would absolutely love it, give it a try again because I think it might work. So, yeah. So that's going to end that part of the show. And now I want to get right in to our topic for this evening. And the topic is called Behavioral and Emotional Changes After Brain Injury. And part of that, I'm going to look up this thing over here. Hang on just a second. I got to pull up the right notes because I have a lot of notes here on my desktop. and a part of that, the emotional changes, behavioral changes will affect personality. So think of that as a global topic right now because that's what we're going to discuss. So first off, I'm going to tell you about an author, Janet Cromer. She's a registered nurse, and she wrote a book titled The Dark Side of Personality Change. She wrote of her husband's behavioral change after his brain injury. Before his injury, her husband, Alan, was a kind and loving man with a keen sense of humor and had much curiosity. But after his injury, Alan experienced intense anger and confusion. It was almost like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde transformation, and it frightened Janet, understandingly so. Alan is not alone with this type of diagnosis after brain injury. Many survivors are affected with emotional and behavioral afflictions that drastically change their personalities. It's difficult for them to understand their altered personality. And it's difficult for their loved ones to adjust to the changes, too. The person may have gone missing because you no longer know that person as you once did. The person's persona has changed to the where he was, like Alan, very calm and collected, and now is very erratic in his behavior or her behavior. So that's what we're going to kind of look at that today and kind of throw the idea around and see if we can come up with some ideas that might help you if you're going through that, either as a survivor or as a caregiver. But first, I want to introduce my guest tonight. Deb Brandon is a very common, very familiar on this show because Deb joins many of my panel shows, and I'm always interested to have her input. And Deb is a brain injury survivor, and she's the author of her book, But My Brain Had Other Ideas, A Memoir of Recovery from Brain Injury. So if you haven't written Deb's review, you know where to go. Okay. Deb is a, well, go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Goodreads. Barnes & Noble and Goodreads. Go everywhere. But Deb is a recent retired professor of mathematics at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. That's my old stomping ground. I was born outside of Pittsburgh, and I went to college there. And you can read about Deb on my blog. Everybody can say this out loud now, I'm sure. SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. In the search box, type her name, Deb Brandon, B-R-A-N-D-O-N, and a Survivor's Speak Out interview will pop up. And so will many shows on Another Fork in the Road on which Deb has appeared. You can learn more about Deb at her website at debbrandon.com. So check them out, but not now. Don't go now. This is time for you to focus in on the show here and hear Deb again. But after the show, oh, and I should let you all know that Deb, co-author, and I are more than halfway through our revisions of Conversations, and we have a new title now. I have the old title in my notes, but Conversations, and you'll just have to live with that for right now because I don't remember the rest of it. So anyway, we can't wait for you to read that. And we're actually finished our revisions by now, too, so we're moving on. Norma Myers is another panelist tonight, and she is an author and an advocate for brain injury. She's a caregiver and a mom who is going to tell us a bit about a horrific situation that happened in her life with her two sons. In 2012, her sons' lives were changed forever. And, in fact, so were hers and her rest of her families when her sons were in a car accident together. The two men, Stephen, 22, and Aaron, 26, as young adults, were just embarking on their grown-up independent lives with so much ahead of them when their path took an upside-down turn. So Norma is going to talk about how she forever lost her son, Aaron, and how she became the caregiver of her son, Stephen, who lives on with serious disabilities caused by a traumatic brain injury. Norma was my guest on Another Fork in the Road on February 19th of this year, and again on May 21st of this year to continue our conversation. We were talking about ambiguous loss, which is a real interesting topic. It's the loss and the grief that you feel when someone is still alive, but has changed so drastically, like we talked about with the personality changes and things and emotional changes. So this is a topic very dear to Norma. And so you can listen to the shows that I just told you about on SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. And again, in the search box, type Norma Myers, M-Y-E-R-S. And scroll to February 19th. And May 21 of this year, 2023. So on that note, I want to welcome Deb. Hi, Deb. Oh, did I put Deb to sleep? I don't think I muted her. Maybe I muted her. No, I didn't. Okay. Hi, Norma. Are you there?
Hey.
Try this again. Okay, wait a minute. I'm just unmuting. I'm muting and unmuting.
Okay,
what's happening here? Okay, Deb, are you there? Hello? Trying this again. Having a little technical difficulties. Hello, Deb, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Oh, okay, yes, I can hear you now. Something is going wrong here.
Good.
Okay, good. Welcome to the show. Were you able to hear what I was saying earlier?
Yes.
Okay, good. Something went a little haywire over here. Hi, Norma, are you there too?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you. Okay, we're good to go now.
Okay, good. Oh. Okay. I was disconnected earlier, so I was a little worried.
Oh, yeah, you know, that was my fault. I think you had to call
back in.
Sorry. So that was not a technical problem. That was me that time. But okay. So let's start with Deb. Deb, can you tell our listeners a little about you and how you happened on the brain injury scene?
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with cavernous angiomas scattered in my brain. Those are clusters of malformed blood vessels that are thin walled, and they can bleed. Two of mine bled and turned my life upside down. And the only known treatment to prevent future bleeds is to have them removed surgically. So I ended up having brain surgery to remove the two bleeders, and then I ended up needing emergency surgery. So that's how I got into the brain injury community.
Wow, that's a hard ticket to pay. And Norma, I'm going to ask you the same question. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about you and how you happened on the brain injury scene?
Absolutely. The anniversary is coming up of when our sons were just going out for a Sunday adventure together, which was not anything out of the normal because they were best friends and they enjoyed spending their weekends together. But they went to pick up one of Aaron's, I think it was like a bear stands or wherever, hunting stands where he was going to go hunting. And they had an accident, and Aaron, our firstborn, did not survive the accident. Stephen survived with a very severe traumatic brain injury, and we were told that the prognosis did not look good for him to survive. But at any rate, thankfully, I can say that he did survive, and I left my profession at that time and went with him to the Shepherd Center where we did everything possible in rehab. And thankfully, here we are today talking about, sadly, it's two-sided. You know, we did have to say goodbye to our firstborn, but we were able to get Stephen back to the point of independence.
Wow, and that must have been a long road. I know when you
it was a very long road. That was very abbreviated to be respectful of our time together. But yes, it was a very, very long journey for everyone involved. Yeah, we had to watch Stephen.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say we had to watch our son go from infancy to adulthood as far as being able to just sit up, say his first word, eat, drink, walk, talk, everything. It was just pretty much like having a newborn all over again. That's pretty much the best way I can explain our journey together.
And that's an excellent way to spend to explain it, because Norma, at least for me, and I'm sure for many, many caregivers of survivors of traumatic brain injury, they can recognize those signs that you're talking about too. My husband David was a professor at Columbia, and at age 57, he had a traumatic brain injury and was reduced to that infantile state also, that infancy thing, where he had to start all over again, learning to walk, talk, eat, dress. I mean, just everything. So I know what you're talking about, and it's just devastating to see that, you know, a grown-up, very respected man, or as your son, a young adult who is, you know, just in, embarking on his adult life, to be taken down so far, to have to start all over again. So it's a huge journey that these men did, and many, many survivors must do to regain some kind of resemblance to some kind of life that they had beforehand. And it's really, really difficult. So thank you for sharing that. I want to explain a bit about how and the why of behavioral and emotional change after brain injury happens. And that's just one small part. It's a very intricate and important part of recovery, and it's an important part of the afflictions that happen to survivors, because it's so misunderstood by everybody. Not only, you know, not only the people around the survivor, but also the survivor himself or herself. So I want to just explain a little bit about the brain so people can get an idea of what is happening here, where it's happening and why. So the brain is actually a very, well-oiled machine. And basically it runs your body. You know, everything has to basically go through that brain to happen. And I like to compare it to the motherboard of a computer, because the motherboard is the central communication center in a computer. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. I mean, we don't know exactly how it works, but we know, everyone's heard the word motherboard if you've been on a computer, and you know that that's got the inter runnings of this, and it's making everything happen for you. And it connects all the parts to each other, and it makes everything work in synchrony on your computer. When it's working well, your computer is working well. And when it's not, you've got problems, and then you're going out to the Geek Squad or something like that. So whenever any part of the motherboard is damaged, it can't do its job, and things go haywire. I said that word earlier, I think, when we were in the green room still, because it's my new word for the week. Haywire, it means jumbled. And that's just what happens in a brain when any part of the brain is damaged. So I want to take a look at the main parts of the brain and glimpse their primary functions. So I want to go to the cerebellum. Now, if you put your hand at the back of your neck, at the very base of your head, that's your cerebellum, base of your skull, and it controls your coordination, your balance, your equilibrium, and all your motor skill memory, so that you, and that's what, when Stephen wasn't able to walk in the beginning or wasn't able to talk, he still had motor skill memory there, and that had to be reawakened. Some of the problems that result from damage to this area are compromised balance, or the inability to walk, which happens to David, problems with fine motor skills, and slurring of speech. Those are just some things in the cerebellum. Now I'm going to move up to the temporal lobe. Now, if you take your hand and put your right hand on your cerebellum at the base of your skull, and now take your left hand and put it right above there and almost touching your ear, okay, and on both sides like that, then you're going to have your temporal lobe. And that can cause problems with hearing, memory, and, again, motor skill memory. And injury in the temporal lobe may also result in aggressive behavior. So if you're having issues with personality or emotional or behavioral changes, you may have had some damage in that area. Okay, now the occipital lobe is right above the cerebellum and between the temporal lobe. So when you put your hand over your ear, you can almost put your fingers there, and right above your cerebellum will be your occipital lobe. And that has to do with vision and vision-related activities. So reading and writing will be affected by damage to this area of the brain. And vision impairment can occur, which includes blurry, tilted, and double vision. And so most of David's injury happened in the cerebellum. So a lot of his injury is that brain, the balance and the motor skills there. But the occipital lobe was also damaged. So that must have been, you know, where his bleed was, the subarachnoid hemorrhage that he had, because he is also, his eyesight is extremely damaged with blurry, tilted, and double vision. So I'm assuming that the occipital lobe was also a part of his issue. The parietal lobe is going to be almost at the crown of your head. And now go from the cerebellum, put your hand up to the occipital, and now go up to the crown of your head. You're almost touching. And there you are at the parietal lobe now. And that runs up pretty much a hand around the crown. And that is responsible for touch and the interpretation of visual information. So problems that may occur with damage to this lobe include difficulty in naming objects, difficulty with reading and writing also, and with spatial perception, problems that can cause, can affect coordination. So there's a lot of that going on with that. Now the frontal lobe, and that's where we have much of our issues that we're going to talk about today, the primary issues of emotional and behavioral changes, the personality, is all based in the frontal lobe. Now, if you put your hands, double your hands in front of your, on top of your forehead and wrap around, and that's going to be the frontal lobe. And if you go down further, you're going to touch the temporal over your ears and then down to the cerebellum, moving up to the occipital, on top of the cerebellum, and up to the parietal. And those are your main or the main parts of your brain. And your emotional responses and your expressive language are housed in the frontal lobe. Emotions and the skills for problem solving, so your executive cognitive thinking, is also dealt with there. The frontal lobe helps folks to make sense of themselves, make sense of the world around them. And it's needed to understand others and be empathetic to them. Essentially, the frontal lobe is the emotional and social control area, and it also determines and it steers personality. The prefrontal cortex of the frontal lobe controls the analytical thinking, and that's what we're talking about when I just mentioned executive decisions, thought analysis, and behavioral regulation. Executive functions are controlled there. So the prefrontal cortex is the gateway for making good decisions. And when this area is injured, the thinking process is affected in such a way that inappropriate behavior is often the result. So although each area of the brain can contribute in some ways to emotional and behavioral changes, it's the frontal lobe and the area that is the area that usually causes most damage. So when you trip and fall and you hit your head, what do? You hit your forehead. When you're in a car accident and your head goes forward into the dash, you're hitting your frontal lobe. If you're punched in the face, you're a boxer, for example, frontal lobe. So a lot of those kinds of things can happen with the frontal lobe. And so that's why there's so much personality change or behavioral or emotional change within a survivor of brain injury. Now remember, it's not only the frontal lobe, it can happen elsewhere as well. So on that note, giving that much information, I'm going to ask Deb and Norma if either Deb or Stephen, Norma's son Stephen, has been affected by emotional and or behavioral changes since your brain injury. And if so, can you talk about them and how they affect you in your life? So, for example, for Deb, why don't you start, Deb, and talk about how it affects you in your life. And then when we get to Norma, we're going to want to know how it affects Stephen's life, if that is a factor in his life, and also how that affects you and your family, because that's another venue to look at. So, Deb, can you talk about how emotional or behavioral changes have affected your life since your brain injury?
Well, well, first of all, just the idea of going through a life-changing experience is going to change who you are. But in terms, so the angiomas that bled, one was in the right parietal lobe and the other was in the brainstem. Now, so pinpointing what affected what, it's pretty difficult because once you're talking about the brainstem, you're talking about the main highway that everything goes through. And put that together with the fact that it turns out that through the years, and some of my angiomas it's really tough to pinpoint because I have several of them scattered throughout my brain, so to pinpoint which did what is not easy.
That's a good point.
In terms of how it affected me, well, emotionally, so what happens is often with a brain injury is you lose filters, and one of the filters deals with inhibition or disinhibition. You lose that filter, and that can cause inappropriate behavior.
Can you tell us what disinhibition is?
So a lot of social niceties are ruled by inhibitions. Not everyone, but I mean, for instance, to be blunt, one of the things that is a bit problematic with some brain injury survivors who suffer from extreme disinhibition, you don't masturbate in public. That's just not done. But some brain injury survivors, their disinhibition is their disinhibition is such that they will masturbate in public. Now, that's an extreme example. I know with me, for a while there, I was swearing much more than I usually do. It's not necessarily just to do with inhibition or disinhibition. It's also to do with having trouble accessing words. What's the first thing you think of? Maybe a swear word. I don't know. But I was swearing more than I did for a while until my brain started healing. I still swear, but not as much or as frequently.
Oh, I know.
But the other common one is rage, and I did have some trouble with that. I recently, for the book you and I are working on, Donna, and apparently on the order of 60% of prison inmates have suffered a brain injury. Now, it wouldn't be a shocker if at least some of them are there because they became enraged and didn't have the tools to reel it in and ended up harming someone or something. In my case, I did deal with rage, but my filters weren't so badly damaged that I couldn't rein it in. One of the things that I did, I was on the phone to my ex-husband, and he just kept on and on and on and on at me, and finally I just lost it. But my rage, I expressed it by taking the phone and throwing it onto the bed, and it bounced twice. So it wasn't exactly harmful, but if I'd missed the bed, maybe it would have been. I don't know.
Yeah,
but the thing is, I did feel like not so much anymore, but I'd feel this rage, and I try and get a handle on it, and sometimes I fought tooth and nail to not let it out, not let it, the poison come out of my mouth or into D's, like slamming things around.
I have slammed things around, but God, I haven't in many years. I mean, I'm now, what, 15? I forget how many years post brain injury. But the rage is practically non-existent now. I don't remember a recent period when I lost it. Now, so that's the bad stuff. But if you're going through, what else is there that's bad? Oh, depression. That's something I refer to my brain injury as the bloody brain because it got bloody, and I'm bloody brain without people thinking in terms of a horror movie. Someone's rummaging around in your brain, which certainly happened to me with the surgeries, there's a decent chance that they'll mess up the chemistry, the balance. And in my case, that definitely happened. I ended up with severe depression that is well managed with medication. But it took me a while to realize that it was clinical depression. I just thought it was circumstantial, or situational, that it was, I'd been through hell and back, and it gets to you at times, it turns your life upside down. Recovery from brain injury is horrific. I mean, I went through some very nightmarish times, and I thought, it's natural to be depressed from something like that, but it didn't get better. I did deal with suicide ideation a few times, clung bout. I had promised my sister and a good friend that if I ever thought of suicide again, I would let them know. Well, I didn't. I mean, I did the previous ones, but I didn't this time because I didn't want them to try and stop me if I decided to put my plans into action. And that was when I climbed out of that deep, dark hole, was that when I realized that, yes, this is not just situational. I've got to go see a psychiatrist and get some medication. And it took, things with depression, it can take a while for, to get the right medication, the right dose and all that. And I went through the ups and downs. And I must say that I'm very lucky that it's very much under control. I haven't experienced any kind of suicide ideation. I'd say, oh God, in years, I can't even quantify, but I don't remember when the last time was. It was, and I must tell you, having gone through that, I am terrified of getting so close to the edge. It's the darkness is just awful, and dealing with suicide, suicidal thoughts. I mean, people think that suicide is a sign of weakness, or it's a self-centered way of dealing with life. I don't know. It's not. I mean, you don't want to kill yourself. You think you're doing it in my case, and I talk to other people I'm not sure if this is the mechanism that happens with everyone who has gone through suicidal ideation, but if anything, you don't want to kill yourself, but you don't want to be a burden, and you're convinced that if you continue living, you will be a burden on your friends, family, anyone who loves you, and you're convinced of that. You're way past thinking in terms of it would be rough on whoever you leave behind.
Yeah.
You're past that. You're thinking in terms of, I'm just bringing everyone down with me and, this kind of stuff. So I've heard some person refer to it as an act of courage. And I know that's hard to swallow, but I understand it because we're all afraid to die. We don't want to do that. And when you actually do it, there is a level of courage involved. But anyway, I lucked out. Don't want to go there. No, thank you. I will stay on my meds forever, you know. So
good
in
idea.
Behavioral, in terms of behavioral changes, during the first couple of years, I went through these ups and downs. I was like a yo-yo, going from really giddy and excited to down in the dumps, thinking of suicide. It was a nightmare. It was just thinking about it is really it gives me the willies. Anyway, that's me.
Okay. And Norma, how about you? Can you talk about Stephen? Has he had behavioral changes that have affected his new self?
With everything that Stephen's been through, and after hearing that, I'm so sorry for everything that she's been through. I just, Stephen's biggest struggles, well, I don't want to say biggest struggles because we have to remember Stephen's dealing with a double sided. He's lost his best friend and is living with a traumatic brain injury. So I know he had to deal with sadness, loss, and grief. Once he learned about Aaron's passing, which he didn't for many, many months because we had to make sure that he was well enough to be able to process that. But thankfully, we did not experience, like, rage. I think that one of Stephen's struggles was there was some, I think, anger just because he couldn't remember anything because, you know, with TBI, you don't remember. So, of course, he didn't remember the accident. He didn't remember losing his brother. And then, you know, he just had to start doing the work to get himself better. I think a lot of it was with him, again, was memory, attention deficits, and then just, I think that comes, one thing that comes along with being a man is just the independence thing. You know, he realized he had to do, to learn everything again. Even once he got the baby steps done, he had to, you know, do, get behind the wheel again. He had to get his learner's permit again. And so just, you know, learning that independence. And I think just being overwhelmed. And also, he did not want to be defined by his deficits. So, educational piece for family and friends to try to let them know that, number one, brain injury is not contagious. You cannot catch it. And one of the biggie for me is, there's no cure. So, you know, trying to teach his future significant others that this is lifelong. You know, if you sign up for this, it does not go away. And also I think that, I don't know, because I think you said it when we were doing our pre-show, I didn't know anything about brain injury until it was laid into my lap. And so there's this label that brain injury is that the person cannot speak. They have no realization of what's going on around them. And that is so not true, but it's because of education. We have to educate. That's why these support groups are so important. That's why we have to be advocates for our survivors.
Exactly. I so agree with you. I think that's why these podcasts, these radio shows, the blogs that we, you know, all the writing that we all do, the books, we just need to get this message out there to the general public before something happens to you, not after. You know, you and me and Deb, we all had to learn after the fact. And if people would know a little bit more about brain injury before it, you could at least have some understanding of it. For example, cancer used to be something such a taboo thing so long ago in the 50s. People didn't understand it. They were fearful of it. It was like a life sentence if you had a cancer diagnosis. And it's taken 50 years. It's, you know, where people, now we say the word cancer, and it's not the C word anymore. People understand it. They know that help can be provided. And that's the thing, the help can be provided. But with brain injury, it's like that beginning stages of cancer when they were just starting to learn more about it. And I think people, the surgeons, neurosurgeons and scientists don't know enough yet about brain injury. We're learning. Everybody's learning right now. And I think in 50 years from, okay, say 50 years from maybe 2000, maybe in 2050, maybe more people will know more about brain injury, and not because they had it first.
Yes, and if I could just throw in a little word there, like when Stephen got, I like to say promoted, because, you know, from ICU down to PCU, and that scared me because, and it's nothing against the medical profession, but it was very obvious because the nurses would come in and they would automatically see brain injury, and they would, like, yell, and I would have to remind them, he's not deaf, he has a brain injury.
Yeah.
And to me, that should be something that, you know, nursing and doctors should educate, and that's why I try to educate them on it as a volunteer. But it's just that type of thing, and just all of the things that Stephen has to be so mindful of. Like, I could go to work tomorrow, I don't have to worry if I have to work overtime, but he has to think about being exhausted. Will that bring on for him, you know, he has epilepsy. Will that bring on a seizure because of his brain injury? So, I mean, I just feel like people take, you know, so many things for granted, but if we can just educate and try to just bring more awareness, just as family members, you know.
Exactly. And when you brought up that part about the educating and then the nurse coming in and yelling because she didn't understand, obviously, that what the needs are. And for David, and one of the things that I did early on, because David walked funny and he looked funny, and I'm not saying this in an exact way, but his face was droopy. And it scared
people.
And, you know, and his voice was raspy. It scared them. And so when we finally got to go out to dinner, I would, I'd make a point of letting people, first off, they would ask me, as the woman, as most waiters do or waitresses, what would you like to order? And I would give my order. And then they would look at me and say, what would he like? You know, and it's like, he's there. He's sitting here in the flesh. You know, ask him, because you wouldn't have asked me in any other case. But because he looked different, they figured he couldn't answer. And those are the kinds of things that I think that we need to make people understand and realize in our daily lives, which I know you do, and which I always, because that's the only way we're going to inform the public and let them realize.
Exactly, and Stephen works in retail, and, you know, he has a deficit. He does not have full functional use of his hand, and he would rather someone just ask him instead of staring and not understanding, because Stephen is very forthcoming, and it kind of goes back to just understanding the emotional piece of this. I mean, early on, we didn't understand. We had to learn about Stephen's irritability or his mood swings, but we learned to not take that personally, because that was part of brain injury. And it's just like educating the public. You can ask Stephen. He will share his story. And everybody that learns his story, they can learn from that. When they see another person that has, you know, a deficit, and that deficit does not define the person, and they want to explain it.
true. I get that totally. Okay, I'm going to move us on a little different tangent here. How can caregivers, family, and friends help? And I'm talking about many errant behaviors are presented when the survivor is faced with repeated frustration. Now, you just said Stephen would become frustrated because people would not take him at face value. They would think he couldn't do something. That's very frustrating. Some examples of this repeated frustration can come from a survivor's being slow processing. When a person has difficulty understanding even the smallest bit of information. So how can folks help somebody that's having a slow processing, if that's part of their disability? And I think that one of the things folks can help by is breaking down the information, giving it to them in small chunks so that the survivor has ample time to process it and understand it. Test back with them, have them repeat it or something. It depends on the level of the disability. And can you add anything to that, either of you? What might help somebody that has a slow processing going on?
Well, it's interesting because I've been on shows with other brain injury survivors, and we're very patient with people. We wait until they say what they have. But there are times
right.
when it's so slow that it really stops us from interrupting. And, for instance, in a tough situation, the speed can be really problematic. You need an answer quickly. As a teacher, there were a couple times when I didn't have an answer quickly, and I felt absolutely horrendous about it, but there was nothing I could do. I mean, my brain couldn't process it fast enough. And the only thing I can a lot of patience, a lot of understanding. And I know sometimes, when I talk to other brain injury survivors, sometimes it's really, I was on a show where I was being interviewed, and one of the people on the phone, one of the people who was listening to the show, I know what it was. It was a panel-type situation, and she wasn't on the panel. She was a patient who was listening in, and I was asked a question, and she answered, and I tried to... And she was very slow with it. How do you deal with that? It's really tough. And there are times when there really isn't much you can do. Just do your best. But thinking slowly is a big one. And it's not just thinking, it's having trouble accessing words. I mean, to this day now, it got worse. And I have trouble remembering names. I have trouble accessing words. I can see how that could be really frustrating for someone. I tend to just laugh at myself. If someone, for me, it's funny and it's how I deal with it. But I can see how it could bring on frustration and rage for that matter.
Oh, yeah. I had a guest on the show one time, and he was very, very slow in his speech. And I knew him personally, and he'd been to my home and everything. So I was very much aware of that. And I knew when I invited him to be a guest that I would be giving a lot of air time to quiet time because I had to give him the space that he needed to spend his words, to be able to say what he needed to say. And I knew that I could not rush him. And that was, and that's something that some people just don't realize. They think if you're not talking, they want to help you out,
right.
They want to provide the word for you or whatever. And that isn't what a survivor needs that is having problems processing or, as you said, word retrieval is something very that happens to a lot of people, and that's causing the slower processing. They're trying to figure out what you said. They're trying to process it through their brain, and then they are coming back out on the other side with an answer. And all of that, normally, for most people in the regular world that haven't had a brain injury, you can do that. You can do that pretty quickly. These things, I don't
and
know
Donna,
where these words
that,
are coming out of my mouth right now, but they're just coming, That kind of thing.
And that just leads me into
something very important, if I may interject there.
Sure.
I said that just leads me into something very important to interject there, if I may. That with Stephen, it's fair. I have to be very mindful to respect and not rescue.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Respect and not rescue. That's a good little phrase there too, Norma. Maybe
that's
I'll
hard as a mom. You know,
respect
it's hard as a mom
rescue.
Not to want to rescue him, but I want to respect that he wants to be independent. And while I want to come to his rescue, he needs to have that respect to do things independently. And also,
exactly.
I think one of the other important things that we can do, which you do every day, and I try to as well, and I know your other guest does, is just put those resources out there to our loved ones, our family, our friends, and our community so that they can learn and grow with brain injury.
Right, right. Another thing, it takes an overly amount of time sometimes for survivors to complete a project. It would have taken them only a few minutes prior to the injury. For example, like taking out the trash or recycling. Folks can help by encouraging the survivor to tackle maybe only one job at a time. Take the trash out in the morning. Take the recycling
Absolutely.
Out in the afternoon. Or even the next day. Or it might help some survivors to have the steps outlined for them. Okay, now you're going to open up the cabinet. And I'm not being silly. I'm saying these are the kinds of things that some people need. They open up the cabinet, take the bag out of the container that it's in, tie it up, walk it to the door. You know, I mean, sometimes you need explicit directions for a person to understand what to do. And that's okay. You know, once the person has done it maybe several times, maybe the memory will come into it and be able to take over. Those are some of the things that you can do to help. And another example is one that affects many survivors, and it's deficient concentration and organizational skills. And these can be infuriating. Organization promotes simplicity. You know, when you have something organized, you don't have to reinvent that wheel every time. But lack of organization, it fosters chaos. And a person living with a brain injury is likely to be living with his or whole life in chaos. So I think folks can help by demonstrating organizational skills, starting with the most simple and the most mundane, by creating a daily schedule or an with little deviation, allowing the survivor to know what to expect each day. I know I often will come up to David and say, hey, you want to go to dinner?
And he goes,
nope. You know, he's like, I didn't plan for that today. My day is planned out. I know what I'm going to do today. And before his injury, he would have said, sure, let's go. You know, but now it's a different thing, and I have to understand that. Sometimes it's not so hard to not so easy, I mean. But I do have to understand that because I'm a person who wants to be just spur of the moment sometimes, you know. Let's go out to dinner. Sometimes he says yes, but a lot of times he'll say, well, can we go tomorrow? And then I go, well, okay. But something like that, you know, taking away from the schedule can cause an unsettling effect. And but having an organization and knowing what to expect today, each day can add a sense of calmness and security, and it can ease the frustrations of the unknown and promote well-being. What are your thoughts on that?
So there's one issue with that that's tough.
Deb, you're getting a little far away. Deb, are you getting a little far away? I can barely hear you.
Okay, just a second. Try
again. Okay, you're sounding better now. Sound like you were in the
other
room.
Okay, so one issue with that you and I, Donna, have talked about is communicating with a brain injury survivor. That it can get kind of tricky by helping them too much, or you might hurt someone's feelings, you might add to the frustration that you need. Brain injury survivors get frustrated that they need the help, and they might feel like you're rubbing their nose into it. It's there's some tricky issues there. I mean, a lot of brain injury survivors tend to be really hypersensitive, and that's and talking about filters, I'm not just talking about emotions. We're talking about sensory input, but it also affects emotions, because I know that when somebody criticizes me or says something that I might somehow conceive as a criticism, I have a lot more trouble with it. I mean, people often don't take criticism easily. It'll reduce me to tears. Even though I know it's ridiculous, it will reduce me to tears. I mean, though I forget what it was, but one of my good friends said something. She didn't mean it in any bad way, but I had to leave the room because I was beginning to tear up. And, you know, it's like a little kid. So communicating with a brain injury survivor can be tricky. So a lot of these things that we can do to help, or you know, you have to be really, you have to be diplomatic about it.
And
it's ridiculous. It gets in the way of communication. Once the brain injury survivor has healed to a decent extent, then you can revisit, you can talk, you can communicate. And, you know, communication is really key with this kind of stuff. And it's communicating
absolutely
with the public,
yeah,
communicating with the brain injury survivor. Between caregiver and brain injury survivor, God, I'm glad I don't have to deal with a brain injury survivor. I mean,
that's where respect comes in, and education. Education, because your point is so validated.
I think the term respect is really, really key here. If you respect someone, you will treat them well. You will be patient with them. You will give them the benefit of the doubt.
Absolutely.
Respect is huge. I was going to say something that was, of course, very crucial, but I don't remember. Well, chances are it wasn't that crucial.
Oh, well. We're running out of time anyhow. We only have a couple more minutes.
As usual.
This went by so fast. I can't believe it. There were a couple more points I wanted to get to. I'm going to talk about what can one do with irrational behavior by the survivor. And I think one of the things is to remain calm, as you can, because you're still human, you know. Try to understand and acknowledge their feelings and emotions. Try to discern the reason behind the flare-up and listen carefully with no blame. And that's what I would say what a survivor, caregivers and loved ones can do to help diffuse the situation it started. What happened? How to identify the survivor's actions immediately prior to the outburst? Look for known triggers that can cause an outburst or irrational behavior. Sometimes the same thing will set somebody off. So I had an example I was thinking about earlier about say your friend's dog always sets off your TBI survivor, and your friend likes to come over a lot and brings that dog. Well, you know, the easiest solution to this problem is to ask your friend not to bring the dog along when visiting. You can still visit with your friend, but you're not going to aggravate the situation with your survivor. And that's just a simple explanation, but I think that it's something important to think about in your own situation. How can you suppress that behavior, you know, or maybe change the behavior or redirect the behavior? So all of those kinds of things. And then I think also one of the things, and Jeb, I think you covered this pretty well earlier, but to get counseling. If your survivor is having this kind of issue, then they really probably could be helped a lot with counseling. You as the loved one or the caregiver may also need to get the counseling to help you get through situation that you're not quite understanding this. It's a two-way street. If you feel that's necessary, then do it. There's nothing derogatory about talking to a psychologist or a behavioral therapist. So So look them up online, find out more about it. And mm-hmm. I think at that point, we have to stop, ladies, because I have to free up this studio for the next host. So I'm going to say
thank you.
Thank you to Deb Brandon very much for
thank
sharing.
Thank you.
And to Norma Myers for coming on and for sharing so much of both of your lives and offering hope to other survivors and caregivers. And you can always learn more about them by Googling them on Google, of course. So you can also go to survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com and type in Norma Myers,
E-R-S.
E-R-S. Yeah, wow, that went out of my head. M-Y-E-R-S. So I was thinking about the first E, and I'm like, I know there's not a first E in there. Okay, never mind. M-Y-E-R-S. And Deb Brandon, B-R-A-N-D-O-N. And also look there for brain injury resources. Check out the Survivors Speak Out interviews. There are lots of interviews on there about people who have put their life story out there for other people to peruse and maybe help them. And also caregivers. We have our stories out there too. So check them out. You can read more about my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, at DonnaFigurski.com. And don't forget to look for it on Amazon and review it. I hope that mountain has been moved for you, too. So remember to tune in first and third Sunday for my shows. And my next show will be on, get the calendar real fast, what is this month? August?
You'll be in September.
August 6th right now. So my next show is going to be August 20th.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's going to be about survivors and caregivers, what they want to hear and what they don't want to hear. And Dawn Corbelli is going to be the guest on that show. And then in September will be my next panel show. Yeah. And I hope to see a lot of you on hearing of that one, too. So, and on the second and fourth Sunday, don't forget to tune in to Lisa Dreyer. She is the host of Mess with MS. And I think there's a show coming up at 7 p.m. tonight, but I am not positive. So if you loved my show, please tell 10 of your friends. If you hated it, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me. So I'll see you on whatever date I just told you that is split is straight out of my mind already, August 20th for Dawn Corbelli and what survivors and caregivers want to hear and don't want to hear. And on that note, thank you so, so much, Deb Brandon and Norma Myers, for joining me tonight,
making my
Sunday evening so much fun.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. Bye.
Good night, everybody. See you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.